This is the 23rd of November, 2008. My name is Todd Moore. I am interviewing today Rush Wells. He served in the Vietnam War, and my birthday is 5487.
Rush, mine is 72343.
And where were you born?
Rosedale, Mississippi.
And what rank did you achieve?
I am a Lieutenant Commander, United States Naval Reserve, retired.
And this is my uncle. He's my mother's brother-in-law. And were you drafted?
No. I went through the Naval ROTC program at Vanderbilt University. And as a result, I had the opportunity to serve on active duty immediately after that.
So what first got you involved in the military?
My family has been in the military for four generations.
Starting?
My great-grandfather was a brigadier general. My grandfather was a colonel in the cavalry with a number of expeditionary activities, including the Philippines and the Blackjack Pershing punitive expedition into Old Mexico, as well as World War I activities.
So did you kind of feel like you were destined?
And my father was West Point class of 1940. And he was killed in World War II. The only one of us that was ever actually killed in battle.
So did you join because, did you first become involved in the military because it was a family legacy?
Yes.
And why did you pick Navy?
Because the Vietnam War was heating up when I went to college. And the odds of surviving the war were better if you were in the Navy than if you were in the Marines or the Army. I came very close to becoming a Marine, but I chose not to for that very reason.
Do you recall your first days in service?
You mean when I was in the ROTC or when I was on active duty?
Starting in the ROTC, you recall what all you were involved in the ROTC?
Yes. I had been to a military school, and because of that, I had a number of skills in dealing with people, and some leadership skills, and a lot of complex drill activities for the parade ground. And so I was selected to be on a drill team for our reserve, and ultimately ended up the commanding officer of that drill team.
And what about when you were first deployed to Vietnam?
Okay, I graduated from college in the January of 1966. I got married. I had several schools that they sent me to in San Diego, California. And then I caught an airplane to points west through Anchorage, Alaska, Japan, the Philippines. We flew forever. But ultimately, I caught a ride to my ship on an old tin can that was deathbed destroyer that was over there that I knew the crew on because I'd had a midshipman cruise. Just serendipity. But they were thrilled to have somebody there that could actually stand deck watches and that they knew could do it.
Yeah. What was your... Since you did ROTC, did you not have to do boot camp or...
No. You take naval. I was in the regular naval ROTC for a portion of my time and then went back to the reserve. But I took two of the three cruises that you take, and you take those instead. One you take as a third-class midshipman, and you do all the jobs that any enlisted person does on the ship. The only difference between you and anyone else who is enlisted is that your white hat has a blue ring around the top. On the next cruise, you do the jobs that a junior officer does on the ship. You're not trusted with a great deal, but some.
And do you remember your instructors? Your commanding officers in both ROTC and during your cruises?
Do I remember their names? No.
You remember what they were like at all?
Yeah. I had a very good commanding officer in navigation. Now, I say it commanding officer, he was a navigator, and he taught us navigation. And it was back during the difficulties with Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis, it's come to be called, as history provides. And we used to laugh about Flunk Now. It was the hardest course in NROTC, far and away, celestial navigation. And we used to laugh about Flunk Now and avoid the cold Nashville winter and go to sunny Cuba.
Okay.
And there were others. My drill instructor, the man who ran the unit, was a Marine major, a fine man. I got to know him. It was very difficult for me to tell him that I did not elect the Marine option.
Did he have that much of an influence on you?
He came close to talking me into it.
And where were you? Where exactly did you go on the when you were deployed to in Vietnam?
All right, my ship was homeported in Naval Station San Diego, California. I joined the ship when it was already on deployment in the spring of 1966. I joined it, strangely enough, in Hong Kong. Wonderful city. Got to go there twice. And we operated up and down the coast of Vietnam, back into Subic Bay in the Philippines. Subic Bay in the Philippines was our home port for the Western Pacific, where we stayed. It was directly across the South China Sea, east of Vietnam. It was about a 3-day steam, and we operated back and forth between those. We went other places, Guam, never had to actually go into Okinawa. It's the worst harbor in the world to ever try to approach. Got in a cold sweat when I thought I would have to go there. And we thought we were going to have to go into Okinawa because we were the closest amphibious ship to Okinawa when the Pueblo was seized by the North Koreans. And we suspected very strongly from communications of a quite high level at that point that there was going to be a really bad activity and the Marines would be involved in it. And since we were amphibious, we were the logical choice to pick them up in Okinawa and take them north. We got lucky. It would have been very bad.
And how old were you whenever you graduated from college in
23? I was not quite 23 years old. I spent my 23rd birthday between Guam and the Philippines conducting a tour on board the ship of a dredge that we had picked up in the Philippines. Not the best birthday I've ever had. It's hot and crummy out there.
And how would you describe during that first tour that you had, how would you describe like the attitude, the overall attitude that everyone was sharing, and how everyone was kind of dealing with the situation that they were in?
66 was the days of the Wild West over there. I was the gunnery officer and ran the gunnery division and assisted the first lieutenant in the operations of our deck department, which on an amphibious ship is the primary department on board. I also operated a small boat in some of the coastal waters and rivers of Vietnam. It was truly the Wild West. Nobody went anywhere without an automatic weapon. I personally didn't like helmets and flak jackets. So when I got away from the ship, I took them off. But that's because I was 23 years old, hard-headed and bulletproof. The morale was really not bad on board at all. I didn't think so, and my troops didn't think so. We got along well. There was an availability of drugs, but it was very limited in the first tour, 66. It was much worse the second tour.
And what was the overall discipline? Was everybody at that point very disciplined in how they went about doing things?
Yes, yes, at least on our ship and my boat crew. Now, on the ship, you're talking about a very much more regimented life. When you've got 250 men on a ship that size, if you're not regimented, it would be utter chaos. And everybody responds to the next person up the order, pecking order. On a small boat, it's more relaxed. And when we operated out as a small boat, we got along because we covered each other's backs. And sometimes that was literally the truth.
And what kind of weapons training, what kind of equipment were you issued as far as for protecting yourself?
What do you mean, for the ship or for me personally?
For you personally.
Me personally, I chose not to carry an M16 because at that time M16 still had substantial problems. One day I'll get out a picture and show you of what I carried. It was a Thompson submachine gun with three clips taped together, which totaled 60 rounds. A pair of sunglasses and a .45 hung on my hip. I looked like someone from the Wild West in 1966. I had enough armament on me to start a short firefight.
I know about the horrendous jamming problem that the M16 had. Is that what most of your troops carried?
No.
No?
Absolutely not. The people on my boats, we wouldn't let an M16 on board a small boat. It was too unreliable. Everybody there had access to an M1, an old M1.
M1 Garand?
Yeah. Korean War vintage. Okay. Good guns. Unbelievable. You can run a tank over them, but they keep shooting.
but
the primary armament on the boat, the small boat, was a stand-mounted 50 caliber automatic machine weapon,
belt-fed.
The same thing we're using today in the Middle East on our vehicles. And it's the far and away a wonderful, the most wonderful thing for subduing those little incidents when the bushes start spitting fire at you. But we also carried two M60 belt-fed, much lighter automatic weapons. And we could put out a pretty good stream of fire over the stern of our boat. And we did not go in to confront the enemy. We would normally turn tail and fire over the stern and get away from them. Because they had at their disposal rocket-propelled grenades. And a fiberglass boat that's hit by a rocket-propelled grenade is not a pretty picture.
So did you originally volunteer to go into Southeast Asia? Or was that just...
No, I volunteered to go in the Navy, and that's where they sent me. I ended up in the amphibs for a number of reasons. But once I ended up in the amphibious forces, it was absolutely foreshadowed that I would go to Vietnam.
And how did you feel whenever you got that information? Not surprised?
My family has been in wars for this country for four generations. I'm just the next one in line. I don't have any hero ribbons. I just have five awards of the Vietnam campaign ribbon.
What were your units of assignment and the position of those units?
Well, I was on one ship
yeah.
the entire time, LSD-18, the USS Colonial. And we operated up and down the coast, primarily between Da Nang and Vung Tau. Vung Tau being at the mouth of the Saigon River, and Da Nang being semi-north. We went significantly further north, but it was not as usual. Our normal run was almost like a taxi between Vung Tau and Da Nang. Da Nang and Vung Tau picking up and carrying things. Also go to Subic Bay, pick up stuff, carry it over.
What was the usual cargo?
Well, we carried some... If we were involved in a landing, we carried the tracked landing craft that the Marines ride in that had about 18 inches of freeboard, and we would dump them 1,000 yards off the beach and then anchor and use radar to control them into the beach. If we were carrying cargo, let's see, we transported the first air cushion vehicles that were ever used in Vietnam. We picked them up in San Francisco and took them all away. We transported the first PT boats that went to Vietnam and picked them up, towed them all the way over there. We carried just all kinds of stuff. We would carry trucks. The Marines needed trucks. The well deck of our ship was like the bed of a pickup truck. If the pickup truck were 450 feet long. And it was covered with a landing pad for a helicopter, but that's metal grate, so it was pretty much open. And we could ballast down so that the tailgate of the pickup would be in the water. We could actually go further down and float things in, and that's what we did with the PTs. We had to go way down, float them in, and then come back up. By ballasting on our ship, we could take it down. God, what all did we carry? Cars that we picked up in Japan that guys were bringing home to drive. A motorcycle that I bought over there. There were certain benefits to being in the deck department. You control the ship's cranes. We carried a truly pitiful officer who was literally thrown off his ship at sea by an admiral. He was a dispersing officer who handled money on the ship, and they caught him stealing, and the admiral ordered him off the ship. They put him in a small boat and brought him over to us. Humiliated. We picked up a number of converted landing craft that we used in the rivers. They were very heavily armored and called monitors. And we picked up a number of them and moved them out to various places to be worked on. On one of those loads, the officer in charge of the group I'd gone to Vanderbilt with, and he looked like he'd aged 20 years. He'd never had a man sent home on rotation. All of his people left, either medevac or KIA. It was a crummy job he had. And when they came up out of that well deck, they were really, really happy to have a shower and a hot meal and somebody to hug them and tell them it was going to be okay, that we'd protect them.
Can you describe your first encounter with enemy forces?
Yeah. Da Nang Harbor. And that would have been in the spring of 66. And they took out an LCPL fiberglass boat like I was running about a half mile up the river. And some of the indigenous people began firing from the bank. And we turned tail and skedaddled out of there and returned fire with the 50 and two M60s over the top. And that was my first encounter with them.
And
it was successful. Nobody got hurt.
That answers my next question.
My proudest statement about the war is that nobody in my direct command got a Purple Heart.
Because you did what you were supposed to do.
Yeah, we took the governor off the boat and just ran like, oh, get out. Well, they'll run a lot faster than they're advertised to run, by the way.
I believe. What were some of your more memorable experiences over there?
Good or bad?
Either or.
Well, let's see. There's always the humorous experience that we used to love to drink beer. My boat crew and I would go over to the Naval Support Activities Today. It was an old building from the French-Vietnamese era, and it was decorated on the outside with two statues of white elephants. So we referred to it as the White Elephant. That was Naval Support Activities Today. And we would go over there every time we came in port. And there would always be two people that were detailed to go out and get us some canned beer. Now, you didn't want to drink bottled beer in Vietnam because the locals would take the caps off and put formaldehyde in there. So you always got canned beer. And if you had enough piastres, which was the local coinage, you could find ice, even in Vietnam. And so we would buy that. And we would cool it off. And the shore patrol did not like us drinking beer at the pier. And the captain on our ship did not like to see us coming back to the ship throwing beer cans over the side of the boat.
And why not?
In order to cure this, a 23-year-old genius decided that what we will do is we'll odd man out, and two guys will go to the head of the pier with one of the M60s and hold it. And I mean, hold it. That's the one. And so we had promised them that we would leave an adequate supply of beer for them. And we had a good old time out there drinking beer till the shore patrol came out. And the shore patrol did. And my guys did just exactly what they were trained to do. And they said, no, the pier's secure, can't go out there. And they said, well, we're shore patrol, we're going to. And that's when they full loaded the weapons, and the shore patrol decided that they didn't want them to do anything stupid, so they backed off. The experience is most memorable because when I got back to the ship, as our boat came aboard, the officer of the deck came down and said, the executive officer wants to see you the second your foot steps on the deck. And he seemed to have gotten word about it. And he was a little bit miffed about it and conveyed that to me pretty pointedly. I think his words were, you are in hack, and you will be so long that you will be an old man when you set foot on dry land again. We didn't secure any more piers. We found bins in the river to drink beer around. You have to be able to laugh about it. There were enough people got hurt. A dear friend of mine, Special Forces, went up in the mountains and his camp was overrun. I don't think they ever even got his body out. Yes, I do remember his name. He's on the wall.
How would you describe the enemy as far as their fighting ability and their use of hit-and-run tactics?
Absolutely canny. They utilized the terrain in ways that we just didn't imagine. The tunnel rats, our people, used to go down in the tunnels, but they could disappear and reappear as if they were ghosts. The Viet Cong were indistinguishable from the indigenous personnel. And I mean, you never knew if someone you saw walking down the road in a pair of black pajamas was a farmer, or if you were going to see him that night in your night vision's coat.
How did that kind of affect everyone after seeing that ability, and how did it kind of make people start acting around just the indigenous people?
Pretty cautious. At least my people were cautious. And it would not have taken much to cause an incident. I never was in a situation like poor Lieutenant Kelly got into, but I can understand how he got there and how it happened.
And who was Lieutenant Kelly?
Lieutenant Kelly was court-martialed in San Diego, California, for having commanded a unit that pretty much annihilated an entire village, lined them up, and executed them. I don't know that that's exactly how it happened, but that's how it was characterized. If they had the village lined up and someone began to do something foolish, once automatic weapons go off, it's hard to control them. Saying ceasefire doesn't make it happen. I know of whole villages that have been obliterated because people fired out of them at the wrong time. And fire would be called on that village, and there was no one or nothing left. We would take fire in the Delta at night, and we would call in Puff, the magic dragon. And once Puff fires, it's over for whoever's down there.
Is Puff napalm, or?
Puff was a C-47 with a 20mm Gatling gun hanging out the port side. And they would drop several flares, and then they would circle, and they would fire into an area. And we were told things like, 20 seconds of firing by Puff, and their burst on an area the size of a football field, nothing larger than a rodent could survive. They were several thousand rounds a minute, and 20 millimeters, a pretty good size round. They could sound like you were ripping cloth when they fired. It didn't sound like separate explosions. So, all that by way of saying, we reacted poorly to a large group when someone shot at us. The question is, are you going to let them kill you, or are you going to kill them? And this is what's hard to get across to civilians who have never been in combat. Combat is a situation where there are a bunch of scared people trying to stay alive. And, on the side, accomplish a mission.
So apart from the disappearing acts that seemed to take place, what were the different strengths and weaknesses that you saw from the Viet Cong?
They were everywhere. They seemed to be supplied incredibly. They could use crude means to bring in more supplies than you could ever actually imagine. They were Vietnamese captured back in the boonies. They were carrying two or three mortar rounds, and they were bringing them from Haiphong all the way to the Delta. They were going to walk just to deliver three mortar rounds. If you have enough people doing that, that's a lot of mortar rounds. And they were able to stay resupplied incredibly. They were Aaron? Yes, sir. Well, that's certainly not a problem, Aaron. It's Sunday. Okay, messy hearings are right. Vietnam was a messy war.
Yeah. So, how did you go about staying in touch with everyone, or with family back home, or were you able to?
Letters.
Letters.
And on the rare occasion, a telephone call. Actually, we were tied up to a pier in Subic Bay in the Philippines, and I was standing the mid-watch one night, which is the 12 midnight to 4 in the morning watch. Green young people on the ship get those kind of watches. And I walked over and picked up the phone and said, "Quarterdeck, USS Colonial, LSD-18, officer of the deck, Mr. Wells speaking." And the other end of the line says, "Hi, honey." And I said, "How did you reach me here?" And she had gotten a phone number somewhere. And we were hooked up. But mostly letters. And the mail was few and far between. There was no email. Email did not exist in the 60s. At least not for most of us.
Were you... was it kind of a way to keep going? Just getting the letters? Were everybody kind of... Whenever the mailbag came, did people just kind of gather around hastily, seeing if they got a letter?
No, that's in the movies.
That's what I figured.
When you are 10,000 miles away, your world revolves around the people you work with. And if it doesn't, then you have a serious, serious problem. And yes, it's wonderful to hear from home, and everybody loves to get mail. But it's not like you see in the movies with everybody sitting around waiting to get a letter. Mine would normally be delivered and thrown on my bunk, and I'd get them whenever I got
there. Was it a lot of... Were you under a lot of stress, I assume, for most of the time?
Now, that's... Life on a ship and in combat has been described as hours and hours of utter boredom, interrupted by moments of stark terror. And there's a lot of truth in that. There are times when it's absolutely boring. You're out there smoking a cigarette, drinking a beer, and some yahoo on the bank opens up, and all of a sudden it's a different world. You're scrambling to zip up your flak jacket and get the 50 working, and return fire and not run up on a sandbar on the way. Or if we're on the ship, somebody opens fire on the bank, we're going to open fire with the big guns. Bigger guns.
Since there's a lot of boredom, you were saying, how do you entertain yourselves?
With beer?
Once back on the ship, there wasn't a lot of that. There was some, but there wasn't a lot. Card games, the routine of shipboard life is such that you've got a normal job to perform, and in most of our cases, it would burn up an 8-hour day. You're going to draw normally 8 hours of watch time, broken up into 4-hour segments, doing on watch somewhere, doing something on the ship. You want to eat, you want to sleep. That eats up a great deal of your day. There's not near as much waiting as you see in the old sailing ship movies. When I was navigator, I had no spare time because you shot morning stars, you shot noon sun, you shot evening stars, you stood watches, and you had to make sure the division was functioning during the day. And somewhere in among that, you tried to get some sleep.
What about when you were on leave?
I took very little leave when I was on active duty.
Oh, did you?
I took almost none. I sold the Navy an awful lot of leave when I got out. Sometimes I'd take a few days and we'd go off to L.A. or Disney World or something like that. A lot of times I would do that in on days that I had off anyway, so that when we were in port. When I was in Western Pacific, I never took leave.
Just out of the, self?
Your ship couldn't spare you. The ship needed the people that were assigned to it. And when you're running a ship, three section watches dividing up the people who are actually managing the ship. The ones that are up there driving it, the ones that are running the engines, all the various things that are done on a ship. The crew is divided up into three sections, and that means everybody's got 8 hours worth to take care of during the day. And we usually break those down into 4-hour watches. Then you still gotta clean up the equipment. Make sure that all your star charts are up. When I was navigator, make sure all the reports are there. You got to read all the communications that are coming in that are assigned to you. Some of them you got to read because when I was navigator, there were only 4 of us on the ship with the clearance that could read them. And the CO and the XO did not know. There were 5 of us, but the CO and the XO were not going to do it. So that meant the ops boss, my roommate, the radio and communications officer, and myself could read the damn things. And when it got to top secret and above, we were the crew that read it. That's how I know about the Pueblo. We did a lot of work on during that one. In a little bitty room.
So, on to a, I guess the more political side of it. Why did you ever feel that you were completely told on why the U.S. got involved in Vietnam?
No. And I made up my mind early on that it was one more war we were in, and either I was going to support it and do my job, or I would have a hard time doing my job. And I did support the war. I did not support a lot of the people who were activists back home. The Jane Fondas of this world, I will go to my grave disliking Ms. Fonda for her participation in what she did. I will go to my grave ever appreciative of Bob Hope and the people that took the time to come into areas that were semi-secured and do something for the troops. Some presidential hopefuls of the past did stupid things during the war and came out and burned their medals and walked around marrying women whose name is on ketchup bottles and then decided they were going to be commander-in-chief. You know, and one of his medals, he was on a Swift boat, and we operated with Swift boats up down the coast all the time. And at least one of his Purple Hearts, as reported by one of the docs on the Swift boat network, which you can still get into, was from a grenade he threw. Now, how can you be so stupid as to not get down when you throw a grenade? It's the first thing you teach someone. Throw, duck, that order. When we came back, my ex-wife now, of many years, marched in a whole lot of protests while I was in law school. That caused not insubstantial strife in my house.
Is there any...
But the short answer to your question is, it's not soldiers' jobs to be politicians.
It's the politician's job.
War is too important to be trusted to generals.
Were you ever aware of any racial bigotry? Or was there any that went on around you?
No.
No?
No, one of my best friends was a chief from Alabama. Made the best barbecue you have ever eaten in your life. He taught me to run the engineering plant when I was down there. Chief Bradford, or Brad as I called him, and I used to go out drinking and pull some of the darndest things that I would rather not tell people about. Brad and I were close. I had a young black person who had caused a problem in the deck department, saying that he was being discriminated against. He was an individual with a very low IQ that was taken in under McNamara's theory that we're going to bring people into the service and give them a break. And I talked to Brad about it, and he found it sort of ludicrous that I was going to be a bigot, since he and I were drinking at the time. And but he took care of the situation because it was difficult for this individual to call him a bigot. And he found things for the guy to do that were exactly up to his capabilities. But no, the answer is no. I didn't run across that at all.
Really? Because
we have black people on our ship, and I don't see any problem with having the black people on the ship. And I'm an old Mississippi boy.
So, the people underneath you, were they just a well-knit group, I guess?
No, they were some screwballs. best yeoman I ever had was brought back to the ship in handcuffs and underwear one night. You know, Granicki was the absolute best yeoman I ever had. Boy, should have never started drinking. You know, but I had to get him back in and bring him in under the wing again, and we got him straightened out. He couldn't go ashore for a while, but I had a few people that were sort of renegades, but then I was a renegade. That's why I was sent up the rivers on that small boat.
How did your family? You said you're a renegade. Was it just compared to the rest of your family, or?
No, I approached it as a job, and I didn't really. I didn't feel nearly as bound by some of the spit and polish. I wouldn't have fit in on a cruiser, I'll put it that way, which is spit and polish Navy. But on the ship I was on, I got along great. We had a crummy job to do, and they were far more interested in your ability to do the job and to take men in and out of bad situations and bring them all home than they were in whether or not your shoes were shined.
How do you think you compare to other officers of the same rank around you?
I advanced as fast as was possible under the law in the Navy. I was given an opportunity to be an officer of the deck early on. I was the youngest navigator in the Pacific Fleet for a deep draft vessel. I was still an ensign. I took the job over. I put on my railroad tracks or full lieutenant as early as it came around. And that was 3 years and two tours in Vietnam. We had a special law back then. Formation Steaming Officer of the Deck, Command Duty Officer. I moved up through all those ranks, all those entrusted jobs very quickly.
Was it out of necessity or just out of the job that you did?
No, it's because I sought to move up and was willing to do the things that I needed to do to move up.
And what all of those entail? Is this just good leadership skills or?
Knowledge and leadership skills, yes. And having the brass to go tell the XO that you think you're qualified. You first go tell the ops boss you think you're qualified, and then you go tell the XO. We did have that much protocol.
What was your overall opinion? Do you think how good of a job do you think that your soldiers did doing their duty?
My men, they did an excellent job. I had very few of them that did anything other than reflect credit. I mean, and let's put that in perspective. If my guys went out on the beach and got drunk, I don't count that against them. Okay? I'm talking about their job. They did a good job. They kept a ship running that was a refugee from World War II. And we took it in and out of Vietnam more times than I could remember. It's been as far north as Tiger Island. We just avoided the shore batteries at Tiger Island. We were in the Mekong Delta and took it all the way up the river to Saigon. They did a good job. They kept that thing running. They kept it doing its job. And I am very proud to have served with them.
How did you feel whenever the United States began to pull out of Vietnam?
That we had finally discovered the inevitable, that you couldn't lick the Viet Cong in Vietnam. Not with the political system we had governing the war. And that gets back to your earlier question on politics. It was obvious early on that some of the decisions that were made politically hamstrung us. And we could not win in Vietnam. We could continue to hold our own, but we couldn't win in Vietnam unless we were allowed to win. And if there are areas of the country you can't bomb, if there are areas of the country you can't fire into, and those move from week to week, safe fire zones, if there are certain groups that you are not going to exact sanctions from, then you're not going to win. So when we pulled out, it was a recognition of the inevitable. Lyndon had failed.
And do you recall the day that your service ended?
Just barely. It was an absolutely blah, routine day. No celebration, no big deal. Packed my stuff in a car and started driving east.
What did you do in the days and weeks afterwards? You go back home? And
I drove home the day I got out. I started east. And yes, and I got home about the same time my son was born. I say home. I got to my wife's home in Georgia.
Did you start work, or did you go back to school?
I went back to school. I had been accepted to law school, and I had a few months before I started, and then started law school in earnest. Had the GI Bill, had a work-study program, and ultimately a scholarship.
Did you continue any relationships that you had made in the Vietnam War with those you served with? Did you keep in touch with any of them?
No.
And what did you go on to do as your career? A lawyer?
Yes, there were some incidents that caused me to want to be a lawyer. I had the opportunity back in the old days when you didn't have to have lawyers try court-martials to try a number of court-martials, both for the prosecution and for the defense. And they sent us through a little two-week school, and some of us did better than others. And my roommate and I ended up trying a great number of court-martials because we had a natural bent that way. And interestingly enough, both of us went to law school.
And did your military experience have an effect on how you see wars now? Like, back with Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and now in the war in Iraq?
Yes.
How so?
We should come home. The Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Turks, or the Kurds, or just displaced Turks, are not ever going to be buddies and have a cohesive government among the three. I don't see that. They've been more or less at political and religious war for over 1,000 years. I just don't think that our current or any other president is going to change that. Perhaps 10 presidents from now, somebody may change it.
And how has your service and your experiences affected your life as a whole?
Like, it's taught me to work. I worked hard. Early on, I was sitting, I was going nowhere. I mean, I felt very frustrated when I went on board ship. And I spent several days when I was not actually engaged in supervising my men directly or on watch, sitting in my stateroom, thinking through what I should do. And I finally decided that I must do for myself and convince people that I am worthy of moving up the chain. What is the job I want on this ship? I want to drive this ship. I want to be the navigator. And that was an absurd thing to hope for because I was a young Marine ensign, but I was still an ensign when we pulled into Pearl Harbor, and I was the navigator, having brought it from the west coast to Pearl. And I went up on the hill, and which would be where the command is for the Pacific Fleet, referred to as the hill because it's on a hill, and I was getting a lot of charts and weather forecast and things. And they said, "What's your job on board?" And I said, "I'm the navigator." And they said, "You mean the assistant?" And I said, "No, I drive that thing."
How'd they respond to your age whenever you told them that? Disbelief?
They had a hard time grappling with that. Brown bars and navigator on a deep vessel, deep draft vessel, did not equate for them. They expected at least one silver, if not two silver bars. And that was something that I ran across sometimes in the entrenched hierarchy in the military, as they had their own vision of when someone should be ready to do a job. And it didn't always fit in with a person who was willing to put out extra effort.
Is there anything else that we didn't cover that you want to talk about?
Oh, heavens. There's so much about Vietnam. But most of it, the bad stuff, I prefer not to talk about. That's the reason I told the funny story about the pier. Some of the stuff was not good. The day my friend came aboard and we brought those monitors in, I mean, when he saw me and I saw him, I went up to him. He ran toward me and hugged me. I took him in. We wanted to burn their clothes, but they wouldn't let us. We did run them through the laundry several times. Got showers, warm meals. Like I say, let them know that we would protect them with our ship. I don't know if he ever made it. I know the man in charge of the three Pack Vs, the air cushion vehicles that we carried over to Vietnam. He had no job on our ship. He was just, once a day they would go down and turn on those things and get up on cushion and make sure everything was working. And so he asked me if he could work with me as my assistant in navigating. I said, sure, come on. He was killed one night walking to the latrine when a mortar round came in. There's a lot worse stories than those. That's why I go to the memorial every time I'm over in Taos. There are too many that did not make it back. And when you think about fighting in a war you cannot win, whatever reason, whether it's where we are now, the people will never let you in, whether it's where we were then, and the political elements have chosen not to win, not to take a course to win. Young people are out there dying every day. And there's something wrong with that. You know, Thurgood Marshall, when he sat on the U.S. Supreme Court and ruling on the death penalty, and he was a minority. Not only was he black, he was a minority in the opinion. But he said the problem with the death penalty is that the only people who ever die are the poor and the minorities. And no one should die because they're a poor or a minority. Well, I don't think someone should die because they're young and that's their best chance for employment.
Thank you very much for having this interview with me, telling your part of the story for everyone, and I hope that this has been good for you to speak out and tell your part of the story of the Vietnam War, and thank you for spending time with me.
Thank you for the opportunity, Todd. I appreciate it.